Okay. The mic is a bit weird today. If you can, I think this is good. If you can't hear me, let me know. But it says I have the mic. Great. Okay. Great. So, good evening. And I'm really excited about this evening because we are going to be talking about God. What is God? According to the Gita, and how do we connect with God? So before we start, we're just gonna, as usual, have our consecration. So just acknowledging that our time always is sacred. Every moment is sacred, but just sort of reconnecting to that sentiment now, sort of honoring our time together and perhaps honoring the whole day as we're coming to the end of the day. So just relaxing where we are, whatever that means, whatever feels tight and a bit restrictive. So wherever there's not peace in the body, seeing if you can just let go. And then bringing our awareness to the breath, just to let go of any thoughts and keep our focus on one place. And then taking a deep inhale, sending the breath up and over the skull and dropping down into the pool or ocean of our heart. And from here, we'll just make an offering of our time together to be shared with all beings. How's that? Is that any better? I'm gonna have to keep an eye on it. Thanks. So I don't know where you were. Oh, I hate to interrupt a consecration. But just sort of diving into the heart and acknowledging that we're all one, and that we are in service to that one. So, from this space, we offer our time together. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. Okay. Right. So I'm just going to shut a couple of windows down. Maybe that will help. Keep the mic going. So, yeah, I mean, it's such a big topic. What is God? What is Brahman, as it's called in the Gita? I just sort of, wanted to start with looking at Arjuna and him asking Krishna to explain what is God. And so in chapter 8, and I know we're sort of jumping all over the Gita, in the very beginning he does just this. He says to Krishna, "What is God? What is God?" And Krishna replies, "My highest nature is the imperishable God or Brahman that gives life to all beings and dwells in individuals as the Supreme Self." So there are so many discussions about what God is throughout the Gita, and we'll talk about some of those later. But I think, just the straight up answer from Krishna is simply that God or Brahman is imperishable. And it lives within us. And that's really the key of the whole way that Hindus and yogis look at God. And so we're going to be sort of delving into that. And in chapter 10, later on, he says, "Because I am compassionate, I dwell in your heart." And when Krishna's talking, he's talking From sort of the place of God. He's sort of God incarnate as he speaks, but he's also talking as us. So it's kind of this sort of, it's sort of hard to get your head around that God is speaking through Krishna, but you are speaking through Krishna. It's beautiful. But it says, because I am passionate, I dwell in your heart, and from there remove the darkness of ignorance with the great light of wisdom. And so I was thinking about those parables of God that we often hear. And I pulled a couple up. Let me see if I can find them. I've had a bit of a shuffle around here, so bear with me. Okay. And they are called the Hiding God parables. So I'm not sure if you've heard of these. I'm sure you have heard of them. But what I love about the Hiding God parables is that you can find them in pretty much every tradition. So when I start to sort of share this one that was actually from Armour, you'll probably recognize it. So, and this is so God decided to create the world, and his purpose was to give himself a place to live. So as soon as he's created this beautiful earth full of trees and plants and animals and birds, he began to live there, and everything was just perfect, and God was having a really happy life. And then years rolled by. And then God made this terrible mistake of creating human beings. And from that day on, there was going to be trouble. Because it was a world of duality. And so humans would always have problems. And night and day, human beings would be complaining to God. And no matter what God was doing, wherever he was, they were knocking on his door. So in the end, these complaints drive him crazy, drive God crazy. They drive him out of his mind. And he thinks, okay, you know what? I'll go to the Himalayas. That's where I'll go. And then he thinks, you know, hang on. People are kind of clever. I made them clever. They're adventurous, and they'll soon come. And so an advisor to God says, "Okay, God, what about the moon?" And he says, "No, you know what? You know they're resourceful. They're going to build rockets. They're going to come to the moon and find me. No matter where I go, they're going to find me." So after some time, this aged advisor steps forward and whispers in God's ear, and God's face brightens, and he says, "Wonderful." And the old man suggests this perfect hiding place for God, which is deep within the heart of man. And God says, "Man will never think to look for me inside himself, and he will never find me there." And so I'm sure it's a parable that we've, you know, maybe all heard before. But what I loved was there's also a Sioux creation story. It's very short, so I'll just share it. And it says that long ago, the Creator gathered all of creation and said, "I want to hide something from the humans until they're ready for it." And that is the realization that they create their own reality. And the eagle said, "Give it to me, I'll take it to the moon." And the Creator said, "No, they will go there and find it." And the salmon said, "I will bury it at the bottom of the ocean." And the Creator says, "No, they're going to go there." And the buffalo says, "I'm going to bury it on the Great Plains." And the Creator says, "They'll just cut the skin of the earth and they'll find it there." And then Grandmother Mole, who lives in the breast of Mother Earth, who has no physical eyes but sees with spiritual eyes, says, "Put it in each side of them, put it inside of them." And the Creator says, "It is done." And so I love this because everywhere we look is this story. That's echoed in the Gita of that God is inside of us. That we need look like no further. It is there. It's that we have it all along, and yet we still have all these doubts that that is so. So, what you know? Why is that? What is it about God that we can't sort of wrap our heads around? Why is it that no matter how many times people say to us, "It's inside of you"? And we look through our history of our ancestors from all around the world, and this is what we hear. We can't really get it. And essentially, the trouble is when we're trying to explain God, and as we'll uncover as the evening goes on, is what we've talked about before in our time together, that we can't put the formless into words. So it's very hard for us to wrap our heads around God. So I'm just going to read a little bit from Ram Dass's interpretation on God here. Okay. So he says, you know, in this, when we're looking at the Gita as it refers to God, We're supposed to be talking about, where are we getting to? Like, what is the point of yoga? Where are we going? What is God? And we call it Brahman, which is like the light inside. It's the one of the universe. But there's an interesting predicament, says Ram Dass, in that we're trying to speak of something which, by its very nature, cannot be spoken of. It can't be said and it can't be whistled. Even in giving it a name, in calling it Brahman, we're actually trying to give the form, trying to give form to the formless. And yet, the minute it has a form, then it can no longer be God. Ram Tirth says, a God defined is a God confined. So it's an interesting predicament that we have when we're trying to think about God. So we're trying to sort of extricate ourselves, and yet we're sort of creating this description of something we're aiming for called God. And really, any label for Brahman just isn't gonna do the job. So any kind of form is wrong. And actually, there is something called Parabrahman, which means beyond God. It's beyond God. And the Tibetans have something as well, and they chant Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, and it says gone, gone, gone beyond even the concept of beyond, because of course, for the Buddhists, voidness or emptiness, that's still something. And that still has some sort of form in our minds. So even that can't describe the formless. So I sort of laugh when I think about this beyond God, because I don't know, I think it's helpful. Like, I don't know what it's like in your local towns and cities, but in New York at the minute, it seems there is this trend of restaurants to put the word beyond in front of the product that they're selling. So there's Beyond Sushi restaurant near my house, and a Beyond Pizza, and I always sort of makes me laugh because, but I get what they're trying to say, and that's sort of what Parabrahman means, or beyond God. We're just sort of saying that we can't even put it into words. Like, it's just beyond. The experience is so beyond the pizza we know that it's beyond pizza. So I always sort of laugh when I think about Parabrahman, this beyond God, and this beyond sushi that's in my neighborhood. So Ramakrishna says that one thing that can't be soiled by man's tongue is Brahman, because what Brahman really is cannot be spoken of. So we can talk about it, but we're always talking about it from one plane, about something in another plane. So it's in the name of the word of God. Obviously, it can be a reference point, but it can never really be a definition. Ram Dass talks about Ramakrishna, who was trying to describe God, and certainly he was trying to describe the state of being in God. So he says that, he would be saying, well, I'm in my second chakra and I'm experiencing this, and now I'm in my third chakra and I'm experiencing this, and now I'm in my heart chakra and I'm experiencing this, and now I'm in my throat chakra, and now I'm in my, and then he would just fall silent and like just sit there for hours and hours because it was no longer possible to explain. And then hours later he would come back and he'd say, okay, now I'm in my fifth chakra, and then he'd start crying and say, I wish I could tell you, but I just can't. So even those who have been there, as we know, come back and can never really explain to us what God is. It's such a an experience is the wrong word, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So for Hindus, they say it's the sort of reaching God, understanding God, God Brahman is really about, if they say, becoming the Brahman, becoming God. It's not a I'm here and God is there and I get to know God or I experience God. It's that you become the Brahman. And in chapter 5 of the Gita, it says, when you see the stainless unity of God everywhere, you become established in Brahman. You become established in God. So I love this sense of, like, there is the goal or our connection to God, and this sort of goes back to those parables of God being inside, is is being established in God. There's not a separation. And for Buddhists, we find that a bit clearer because it's you're in nirvana. You're sort of having, it's not an experience, but you're in it. You're established in it. You're there in it at all times. So it's sort of, I guess one way of saying is when you're sort of your understanding of God, your experience of God is actually being in God at all times, operating from God, I guess would be another way of saying it. So Ram Dass talks here about why it's not experience. So let me just try and find that. Yeah. He says to experience something, you have to be separate from it. So for yogis, we use techniques like karma yoga and jnana yoga to arrive at this state of Brahman, to immerse ourselves in it, to become established in it. So some of the things we've been talking about these last few weeks, like bhakti yoga and the path of jnana yoga, wisdom yoga, another practices mentioned in the Gita, like repetition of mantra, making consecrations, they are sort of really trying to immerse you in Brahman. You're sort of getting used to being in Brahman, so bathing in Brahman, bathing in God as you sort of move towards knowing God. But still, you have these questions: what is God? What is God? But through these sort of techniques, if you want to call them that, you're sort of beginning to immerse yourself in God. So he points out the difference between meditation and immersing yourself in God. And Ram Dass says, a meditation practice is one of the first things we often try when we're trying to reach God or trying to know God better. And it's we do so in order to quiet down our thinking minds. And as our meditation deepens, we find we have many different kinds of experiences. And some of those may seem like an experience of emptiness. And it might be a very appealing experience for us that we want to share, but it isn't Brahman, it is not God. And it can't be God, says Ram Dass, because no experience is it. And even the experience of emptiness is an experience. So Brahman is outside the realm of experiences. So imagine, well, I don't need to imagine it. We're sort of trying to get our heads around that. So Arjuna asks this very simple question, like we all ask, what is God? But unfortunately, the answer is not very simple. We can tell you that God is inside you, and that God is there in the heart. it's not an experience. It's something that's not emptiness, but maybe fullness, but it's not fullness either. It doesn't really have a name. It's sort of a very, very difficult concept. So it's no wonder that we do have doubts, because we can't really talk about it. We're so used to talking about everything. So that's where I feel like, and mystics feel like, that's where poetry can come in. It really helps to read other people's experiences of God or their non-experiences of God, if we don't want to use the word experience. Just sort of reading those words or absorbing ourselves in words that seek to describe God can be very nourishing for our soul. So I often think about all the beautiful poetry of the Sufis that talks about the beloved. And if you read the Tao Te Ching, that sort of talks about God in a very sort of beautiful way of just say so for example, in verse 14 in the Tao Te Ching, it says they call it elusive and say that one looks but it never appears. They say it is indeed rare since one listens but there's never a sound. Subtle, they call it, and say that one grasps it but never gets hold. These three complaints amount to only one, which is beyond all resolution. At rising, it does not illumine. At setting, no darkness ensues. It stretches far back to the nameless state which existed before the creation. So, and as Ram Dass comments on this, and he says, that's written by somebody who managed to come just about as close as you can to expressing the essence of Brahman. And it's actually a lovely story about how the Tao Te Ching was written. which is probably not true, but it's a nice story. And it's that there was this keeper of the library at Peking, and he was going home to die, and he was a really old man. And when he came to the boundary between his home province and the place he was leaving, the guards stopped him and said, "You have to pay a fee to cross the boundary." And he said, "Well, how can I pay? I don't have anything." And they said, "Well, what did you do in your life?" And he said, "Well, I was a librarian." And they said, "Well, go and sit under that tree and write down everything you have learned and leave us with that, and that will be your payment." And so he sat down and he wrote out the 81 verses of the Tao Te Ching. That's the story of the Tao Te Ching. I think it's a lovely story. But yeah, I mean, reading the Tao, and as we talked about the other week, when we read koans, sometimes we can get this put in a place where we can begin to sit in this idea of what God might be. And if we don't want to use the word God, then whatever we want to use, whether it's Brahman or divine or Christ or Krishna. Yeah, this sort of help that we have from reading poetry, and the Gita is actually very poetic when it's talking about God. I'm just going to read some of the verses it says. So it says, "I am the source of everything. I am the seed of all beings. I am the home of absolute oneness, who is immortal and unalterable." And chapter 7 is like poetry in motion. "I am the taste in pure water, the radiance in the sun and moon, in all scriptures, the sacred word Om, the sound in the silence, and the virility in all men. I am the fragrance of the earth, the brilliance in the fire, and the life in all beings." So, although, as I say, we can't really put God into words, it's helpful to sit in the poetry of thinking, the poetry of those who have been in the presence of God, should we say, or been established in God. And I sort of feel that that isn't just about sort of the poetry of God, but sometimes when you hear poetry in general, there's something that's very moved within us, or we hear a beautiful piece of music, or someone singing. There is a sense of this, we're not quite sure, but it feels to us like there's something very deep, that it's not an experience perhaps, but that we are within something, or bathed in something, or held in something that maybe we could refer to as God. So there's a lot of help that comes our way just from, contemplating God. Even though, as I say, the words aren't going to get us there, there's a quality that we can begin to sort of marinate ourselves in. And find this, sorry. So Ram Dass talks as well about why it's actually helpful to take them on, or to sort of listen and hear these sort of poetic ramblings that often seem like it's this and it's also this. I'm the light of all lights, but also the dark of all darks. And why that's helpful to us to really contemplate God and who God is. And it says, maybe right now these descriptions seem very abstract to us, and irrelevant to our own lives. But the way they will become our own, the way the bones will take on flesh, is through our clothing them with our own experiences. So just hearing what other people have written about God is beautiful, but it will never be satisfying, ever, ever. We have to feel it for ourselves. And yet the hearing has its purpose. It may resonate in a place within us where we sense the validity of it, where we touch the realness of our identity with something other than what we think we are. And that sense of validity, in turn, gives us faith. So it's right at the point where we touch that sense of certainty in ourselves that faith is generated. And that faith is actually what makes us step in and consent to fight our own battle, like Arjuna here in Kurukshetra on this field with Krishna. So yeah, whenever we sort of read the poetry where we read the words that seek to describe what God is, then it sort of ignites in us, sort of adds fuel to the flame within us that is, yeah, that's almost there, but I'm still not experiencing it. So I'm going to go out and try harder. But also it's sort of, much like everyone has this parable about God inside us, we hear it over and over again, then we begin to realize then it must be true. And so our faith gets stronger and stronger. So there is a purpose, even though words can never describe God, there's certainly a purpose in our reading about it and hearing about it. Okay. So, excuse me. So there is a chapter within the Bhagavad Gita, well, there are two chapters that delve right into what God is. So, and they come sort of in the middle of the Gita. So chapters 11 and 12. And in chapter, sorry, 10 and 11. in chapter 10, Krishna tries to sort of explain who he is as God. And I'm just going to read a little bit from that. Okay. And he says, I am among all the priests, I am the divine priest. Of all military leaders, I'm like the god of war. If I am a body of ocean, a body of water, I am the ocean. I am the primordial horse, he describes himself as the noblest of elephants. He's the king of kings. He's a thunderbolt of all weapons. He's a cosmic serpent. He's the god of water. He goes on, I am the prince of devotion, born to demons, and I am time, and I am the king of animals. I am the wind. I am instruments. And all throughout chapter 10, he's saying this is what he is, and they're very sort of mystical. To us, when it was written, there probably weren't so much. He says, I am death who devours everyone. I'm the beginning, the middle, and the end of everything created. I'm the knowledge of God. I am reason itself. I'm the letter A. And Swami Sachidananda points out that what he's saying here is that when you stretch your imagination as far as it can go, this is who God is. This is where it is. When you think of the best of the best, or the worst of the worst, of the extreme of everything that comes to you, of the most powerful in everything, or the quietest of the quiet, that is where God is. And then after this beautiful chapter where he talks about all these mystical qualities that he has, he then reveals himself to Arjuna. And I wanted to read some of that just so you get a sense of what the Gita really sees as God, and we're going to talk about this in a moment. So in chapter 11, Arjuna says, I beseech you, show me your immortal self. And Krishna says, look at my body. You will see the entire universe there, all that moves and all that seems to be unmoving, as well as anything else you wish to see, all a part of the same, which is me. And I will give you spiritual vision so you can behold me. And then this is narrated by, if you remember back in the day when we talked about this, Sanjaya is with the blind king and he's narrating what Arjuna sees. So he says, everywhere, everywhere, millions of faces, eyes seeing everything, countless mouths all speaking wonders, visions too numerous to describe. All this is he in a bejeweled heaven with infinite upraised arms revealing miraculous powers, a divine weapon in every hand, clothed in mantles of light and garlands of blossoming heavens, the infinite, wondrous, resplendent one. Facing everywhere simultaneously, in the presence of divinity and indescribable fragrance. If a thousand suns were to blaze in the sky at the same time, their splendor would be something like the radiance of this supreme one. There, in the body of the God of Gods, Arjuna saw the manifold universe in its entirety, with its many levels and divisions all resting in their essential oneness. And Arjuna begins to speak, "O Lord, I see all the gods in you. Your body contains every creature and all levels of evolution, and even the Creator seated on the lotus is within you. And I see you in countless forms wherever I turn, in arms and bodies and mouths and eyes, on and on until infinity. You are everywhere, O Lord of the universe. Your body is the entire cosmos. And now I see you crowned with precious gems. You're like a fiery sun blazing in all directions. I can barely stand it. You are so radiant. You are what is to be known. You are the treasure house of the universe, the refuge of creatures, the guardian of timeless wisdom. I understand you are the ancient of ancients. The sun and moon are your eyes. Your mouth is a burning fire that heats the whole universe. From heaven to earth, every quarter is full of your presence." And then what happens is that after Arjuna sees the most beautiful aspects of God, all the aspects that when we think about God, you know, we're like, oh, it would just, you know, so amazing, angels singing, choirs singing, birds flying everywhere. And then he begins to see God, God's other side. And that's often what we think of God having another side. But it goes on, "When I look, seeing you like this, taller than the sky, your mouths open and blazing while colors emanate from you, my heart is pounding with fear and I'm beginning to lose my courage. When I look into your terrible jaws with fearful tusks, I see the fires at the end of time. I don't know where to turn. I see all the sons of Dhritarashtra, the blind king, and I see all the earth's warriors and kings, and Bhishma and Drona and Karna, as well as our own mighty warriors." He begins to see his battle. "And all of them are caught up in this torrent." That's right, it's all aspects of creation. "I begin to see this torrent that's rushing into your terrible jaws and tusks, and it's horrible, and some people are being crushed between your teeth, and their heads are being smashed to powder. Like a raging torrent roaring to the ocean, so are these warrior heroes rushing into your blazing jaws of death. Now I understand that all creatures like moths to a flame are rushing long into your gaping jaws. Your mouths are filled with fire. Wherever you turn, you lick your lips. Your radiance has set the universe on fire. O God of such terrifying form, who existed before anything else, be merciful. I must know who you are, why you do what you do." And the Lord says, "I am all powerful and I'm a destroyer of the worlds, and now I've come to devour this world. Whether you fight or not, the warriors here will surely die." And then Arjuna begins sort of trembling and he's terrified, and he sort of eventually asks him to Krishna to return to his gentle, more like human-like nature. And I say human-like because Krishna's blue. I don't know if you know that, but he's blue. Just to calm his mind, and Arjuna says, "Now that I see your gentle human form, my mind is tranquil and I'm again returned to normal." But this is a really important chapter of the Gita in my mind, because it's not just all love and light. It shows that God is all. So we see God in all his beauty, which is very difficult, as I said, to put in words, but you know, we can sort of imagine if we were to use words, we would use words like the light of all lights and infinite radiance. But what we might not use when we're sort of thinking about God is words like devouring jaws and fiery mouths eating people and sending them to their death, which kind of goes to show us that our concepts of God that we create in our minds are limiting, and we have limited them because we don't include this all when we're thinking about God. Certainly, perhaps when we're worshipping God and singing songs of praise, we're not singing songs of, oh, isn't it wonderful, everyone's suffering and people are dying and walking into your jaws of death without knowing it. We just don't do that. So And so it's really great to sort of contemplate God in all glory and then think about the sort of the rules we've put around the word glory as well. And then we can begin to see how words really sort of stop us from having this, I can't say experience, of sitting, residing in Brahman. So there's this, I mean, it's the whole point of the Gita, and it says it often, is that there's oneness. And as he says later on, I'm the home of absolute oneness. And often when we think of oneness and God, as I say, we think of this oneness, but on the brighter side, but oneness is all. Oneness is one. And there's this Sufi poem called Laughing at the Word Two. And I believe it's Hafiz. And it says, only that illumined one who keeps seducing the formless into form had the charm to win my heart. Only a perfect one who is always laughing at the word too can make you know of love. Which I just love. Excuse me. So there's a book by Robert Adams, who studied with Ramana Maharshi, called Silence of the Heart, and I'm hoping that we'll cover it in a couple of weeks, because it's a really great book. But he talks about what Ramana Maharshi said when he was asked a similar question as Arjuna asks Krishna, what is God? So a devotee of Ramana Maharshi, it says, who had been with him about 25 years, had a son who died, and he was grief-stricken. So he begged to have this audience with Ramana Maharshi. And Ramana agreed, and was sort of reclining on his couch with his eyes closed. And the devotee came in and started to cry and said, and sort of told him how much he loved his son and how he'd lost his son. And he asks Ramana, what is God? And Ramana Maharshi doesn't answer for about 15 minutes. He just sort of sits there very still. And then he opens his eyes eventually and he says, what is God? What is God? And Robert Adams says, everything from the lowliest microbe to the fullest galaxy is God in an expression. Everything is God. Every leaf, every piece of clay, every star, every planet that has no basis for existence by itself, because God is everything else is. Nothing would exist if God didn't exist. The only reason we exist is that God is, which is very, like really, when you contemplate that, that's a very, very deep point to contemplate. That every planet has no basis for its existence by itself, that because God is, everything else is. And that's what Ramana meant when he answered, what is God. He was trying to explain to the devotee that your son dying, that is God, and your son living, that is God. There is no real difference. It's only in your mind. We differentiate only in the mind. So there is only God, and everything that exists, everything is God. There can be nothing apart from God. So how does this help us? And how do we reach this God, and what help does it give us with the knowledge that God is everything? And how, it's all well and good for us, I don't know about you, but I often am known to say, well, God is oneness, there is only oneness, God is all. It's, as you mentioned, like all aspects of creation, God is all sides. But it's not really embodied knowledge for me. I can't speak for you, but it's not something I've had, like I'm experiencing in every moment, that is oneness. So what help is it for us to have this knowledge that we haven't yet embodied, that God is one? It's because if we could just sort of, think about how to live if we had embodied that knowledge. So can you imagine if you knew at all times that God is everything, how you would live your life? So, Ramana Maharshi mentions here, sorry, Ramana Maharshi, Robert Adams says that, it's dualistic thinking, as you say, So, when you sort of come from a place of non-dualistic thinking or trying to live from a non-dualistic place, which is impossible if we're not there, then we'd think that every position that we find ourselves in, every situation with whomever we find ourselves in, is right, is absolutely right. And we would think to ourselves, bless this moment. Love this moment. And it sounds hard when you think of a horrible condition, says Robert Adams, and you say, what do you mean? I must love it. And so he says, well, the reason you love it is because God is all there is. And try to remember that. There is nothing but God. Therefore, if you hate something, you're hating God, which is yourself. It's all coming out of you. If you remember, God is inside us. So you are that. So you must learn to trust and love yourself, your precious, precious self. And his description of God is this: close your eyes. I am boundless space, infinite like the sky. I am not a person, place, or thing, but I am. I am choiceless, effortless, pure awareness. I am Parabrahman. I am Satchidananda. I am ultimate oneness. I am absolute reality. I am nirvana. I am infinite like the sky. I am absolute consciousness. I am that I am. I am. I am. I am. So, can you imagine if we lived like this, loving all, like the loving all method that Michael Langford teaches? That's how we would practice, put this into practice, this idea that all is God, that God is oneness. Experience everything as God. And in the Gita, it says, throughout the Gita actually, that one of the practices for reaching God, one of the practices of yoga and having this sort of immersion in God, is just to be fixed on God, have the mind always, always fixed on God. So whatever you're doing, just always coming back to God. Everything you do, live with devotion. See every moment as holy and sacred. Always offer up at every moment. And there is Ram Dass has this beautiful story about his guru, Maharaji. So Maharaji used to write in a journal every day, which is curious, right? He's a guru. What's he doing? He's an awakened one. What is he writing? And when he died, the disciples of Maharaji took his journal and opened it, and every page was filled with lines, and every word on every line was the same word, and it just said Ram, 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 and Ram means God, which is beautiful. So even an awakened one is wholly focused on God. Ram, 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 Ram. It's just so beautiful. And it also, and we'll probably talk about this when we come back in a couple of weeks. But it's there's a practice that the Gita suggests, is just that you practice so hard, you're always thinking about God. You wake up in the morning and you think about God, and throughout the day you set your alarm clock and think about God. And really just treat every moment as completely holy, every moment as being God is all there is, God is all there is, God is all there is. And then at that point of death, which is not particularly cheerful to think, but with the point of death, your final thought will be God. And then, according to the Gita, you go straight, you awaken straight away upon your death. And of course, all these stories about very holy people. And on the moment of death, they're hit by a car and they go, oh, bloody hell! And boom, they're back in another body before they know it. And that's that, say the sages, is because really you've got to practice your whole life. And if you don't practice your whole life, in the moment of death, you may just sort of naturally not think of God. So I can tell, like, sort of having this one pointed focus on God all the time. Yeah, everything is holy now, which is a lovely way to think of it. But similarly, another practice for sort of immersing yourself in Brahman or in God is actually making ourselves empty. So they're kind of one of the same practices, but the words are slightly different, I suppose. So in one of them, we're like kind of filling the mind only with God, and in a way, we're like purifying the mind with God's energy, I suppose you could say, or with this pure energy. And then the other practice is just making ourselves completely empty, and that would be surrender as a practice. Robert Adams calls this standing naked before God. So what he says, what I'm saying to you is let go of everything. Do not hold on. Stand naked before God, without any crutches, without anything to hold on. When you can do this, from that moment on, you will begin to rise. And you will become aware that you are not the body or the mind or the world or the universe, but you are effortless, choiceless, pure awareness. You are boundless space, infinite light sky. You have become everything, and everything has become you. There comes a time, he says, in everyone's life where they have to stand naked before God. By standing naked, I mean no scripture, no fancy words, no preconceived ideas, and that means no concepts of God either. When you stand naked before God, you don't bring God. There is no God. There is nothing. So no spiritual, intellectual knowledge, not even your devotion. You bring nothing. To be totally naked, he says, is to be in utter humility and humbleness. Therefore, when you can forget about your scripture and forget about everything you've learned and forget about even God as a concept or God as something that you're aspiring to reach and become totally, totally empty, you will then become full. So I love this. And the Gita, does talk about practices of emptying ourselves. And that's really what we all know as spiritual seekers. It's this letting go of the I and the me and the mine, of letting go of taking everything personally, of letting go of thinking that, our small selves matter in some way. Because of course we matter, but often not in the way that we're thinking. So of letting go of the anger, of letting that all go and emptying ourselves out, emptying our cup of what we think we know. Yeah, it's beautiful. The same as two practices of sort of immersing ourselves in God. Krishna, is sort of addressing Arjuna and sort of pushing him really deeper, deeper into these kinds of practices as the Gita goes on. And he says that really until Arjuna is quietened down, until his mind has sort of cooled down a bit, until he's residing in Brahman, he really won't even begin to see Krishna. And that is like we won't see God in everything around him. That really you have to be in Brahman before you begin to recognize that something lies beyond it. So you sort of get caught in this loop of you sort of, the more you sort of seek for God, sometimes the more elusive it can become, but to rest in God and then you begin to understand that there is even no God, there just is, And says Ram Dass says there are those in India who experience what's called, or they go into what's called nirvikalp samadhi. So samadhi is sort of like an awakening, but there are, according to yogis, several stages of this awakening. And nirvikalpa is like the highest form of samadhi. He says, and these beings who reach this level, so they're really in Brahman, just stay there. And after a period of time, my guru used to say 43 days, but he's also heard 21, that the being totally merges into that state and the body just disintegrates. It just falls apart because there's nobody in there keeping it together anymore. which is a pretty interesting way to leave your body. And then there are others who go into that state, that nirvikalpa samadhi, that residing in Brahma, and then reside in it. And their manifestation continues, only now it's different, because now they're Brahman coming through a human form of the sages and the masters, enlightened beings. That's the totally residing in Brahman, residing in God. It's like nobody came back, and yet there is something there. For such a being, says Ram Dass, there are no more rules in the game, because compassion has become all-embracing. Any of our models of you must do this because it's good, or you shouldn't do that, are our limited perspective. Their compassion comes out of their total consciousness of the whole of it all. So yeah, that's that sort of just sitting with a journal, and all your pen can possibly write is Ram. Operating from that space of God, we come to new understandings of karma yoga, a wider understanding. Actually, Trungpa Rinpoche calls it crazy wisdom. We have this outrageous wisdom because the self is gone. So when we talked about karma yoga, as the sort of Gita teaches, everything we do is for service to the one, that sort of meant, you know, for us maybe it means sort of something coming from what we're doing that we hope will get us to the one, that we hope will get us to God, that our actions are like our path and our practice. But once you're residing in Brahman, once you're in the oneness, you're so in relationship with God or the Tao, with the way of things, that all of your actions just are a statement of Dharma. They are just the cosmic order moving through. You are completely acting from karma yoga, but there is no karma yoga. It can't possibly exist because you don't have karma. There's nothing else. It's like there's nobody home once you're eventually residing in God, because the I has gone, but even God itself has gone. And there is just another tiny Sufi poem, where it's not a poem, it's like a saying that I sort of feel describes this best. And that is, pilgrim, pilgrimage, and road were all by myself towards myself, and my arrival but myself at my own door. So I just love this. Pilgrim, pilgrimage, and road were all by myself, towards myself, and my arrival but myself at my own door. And I love this imagery that sort of comes back to the sort of what is God, and that God is inside us, and that the whole journey in the end, the whole path of the spiritual seeker, is really us just coming home to ourselves and finding ourselves knocking at the door and discovering that no one's home. So a sort of big topic this evening, but hopefully leads to some ideas for practice during our lives, as either surrendering or filling our minds with God, or just looking around us and seeing everything as holy. So we've got a couple of minutes. If anyone's got anything they want to share, I'm happy to take a couple of questions. Yeah, God is not only inside of us, God is all. Yeah, it's sort of one of those crazy paradoxes. God is really nothing but everything and inside of us, but we don't exist. It can go on and on. And hopefully when we look at Advaita Vedanta a bit later this year, we'll really get down to this whole sort of, oh my goodness, even God doesn't exist. What does that mean for me as a bhakti yogi or a devotee of God? This whole idea that nothing really exists, it's just this I am. I know we've got a break next week because there's a retreat on, and I'm actually going to be in Ireland. Yeah, I'm going to be in Ireland on holiday, so it's perfect. But then when we come back, I think we're going to wrap up the Gita by just looking at some of the sort of remaining themes, one of which will be death. The Gita talks a lot about preparing for death. So thank you very much for being here tonight. It's lovely as always, and namaste to you all. Hope you'll have a beautiful fortnight and look forward to seeing you on the other side. Thanks.